Broadcasting live from the Business Radio X studios in Atlanta, Georgia, it's time for Disruptive Business, celebrating those who change the game.
All right, this is Lee Cantor with Micah Porter here at Disruptive Business, which features cutting-edge organizations and the innovative leaders who guide them. And today's show is brought to you by Minerva Planning Group. Micah, how you been?
You know, Lee, I can't complain. It's been a pretty good week.
I'm sorry you missed out on Venture Atlanta the last couple of days. It was an amazing event, a ton of emerging companies, a ton of people that are doing disruptive things. And I'm excited to get, we're going to talk to a lot of them over the next few weeks. And we're lucky to have one of those guys that I met there over, what was it, Wednesday, I guess?
Wednesday, it
was. Ortez Gude, and he's the CEO with Cordova. How you doing, Ortez?
I'm doing well.
Now, why don't you talk a little bit about what you guys are up to?
Okay, so
Corvado, I'm sorry.
Oh, not at all. So at Corvado, we focus on the construction and real estate space. We focus on that area for two reasons. Number one, that's where the majority of our team's background was built. But number two, because there's a lot of waste in the industry. The construction market in the U.S. alone is around $1 trillion. They estimate that there's about 40% waste in the construction cycle. On the real estate side of things, real estate is generally the third largest item on companies' balance sheets.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of inefficiencies in that. And so we set up the company to try to help companies deal with that, those inefficiencies and find solutions.
And what was your background that got you even involved in this?
So my background is I spent the majority of my career in the industry. Previously, I worked for Skanska. I was a CIO for Skanska and Beers Construction before Skanska acquired them, and have spent time in the same capacity at a couple of other countries or a couple of other companies around the country.
Ortez, you mentioned a phrase that I'm not familiar with, and that is the construction cycle. Mm-hmm. What does that mean for those that aren't in the business?
So when you think about the construction cycle itself, it begins at the in the early stages of planning a facility. You know, so companies have an idea that they need to expand
right. Geographically
for whatever the reasons, business reasons are. And there's a planning cycle where they determine what their needs are, things like space planning, the physical plant, what does it need to look like, the type of workers they need to house,
mm-hmm.
how does that work? So the architects then kick off kind of the design phase where they do the actual designing of the facility.
Right.
Then it moves into the actual construction. A lot of waste happens during that construction phase because you have site logistics,
mm-hmm.
moving materials around the site,
mm-hmm.
the timing of that, the timing of things arriving, of coordinating all the folks that are involved in it. A typical building, say this similar to the size of the one that we're in today,
mm-hmm.
you may have easily 500 subcontractors that you are having to coordinate. So the fragmentation creates a lot of opportunity mm-hmm. for there to be loss. And then once the facility has been completed, the next phase of it is the actual operations and maintenance of that facility over the rest of its life.
Right.
So now Corvado is a technology company, but also there's some consultative element of your business as well?
Right. So, Lee, when we started the company, we spent the bulk of our time helping companies understand how to better implement technology within their organizations
mm-hmm.
and use it to improve some of those construction cycle processes. We knew in the beginning that there was a lot of opportunity for software solutions in the space and other technology solutions in the space because it's currently underserved. And we spent the first 2 or 3 years really digging down and making sure we had a good grasp and understanding of those needs and testing out some theories we had with a lot of our existing customers. And that led us to our first product, which will be released next month, called Conditions, and it's aimed at condition assessments for buildings and building automation.
And when you say condition assessments, you're taking a look at specific sites and how well they fit the needs of the client?
Right. So that's one aspect of it. So we have functionality assessments
right.
that take care of that, right? You know, and think of it in terms of a natural disaster such as Katrina, where you have a lot of buildings that are damaged or destroyed and you have to determine, you know, we need to set up a triage center. Could we use this building as a triage center? And you go in and you need to do an assessment of the water facilities that are there. Is there enough hot water? What about structurally? Is it sound enough to support the weight load of equipment we might have to bring in, things of that nature? On the other side of it, it has to do with the repair and maintenance of the buildings.
Right.
Because over time, buildings age just like people do. Right. And over time, you have anywhere from 15% to 25% deterioration in the quality of a building. And unless you manage that process well and maintain those buildings optimally, you end up misspending on repair and maintenance. You are more reactive in terms of operating those buildings, and your energy costs skyrocket.
Right.
So it's noticeable. Like you have you when you come in and you can assess the situation, you could see that there's a problem and they haven't been kind of maintaining it on a regular basis, then you can come in and kind of shore some of that up and help them, you know, quickly jump on top of the savings in terms of energy, the savings in terms of safety.
Correct. So typically how condition assessments are handled today is that companies go out and they will hire an engineering firm to actually come in and do what's the most difficult part of the assessment process, which is inventorying the building.
Right.
A typical building has tens, if not hundreds of thousands of components in it. Think of everything from the electrical switches on the wall to the chillers and the other.
Right. The complexity is, you know, off the charts.
Yeah, that's what's striking to me. I mean, you've got so many moving parts here.
Right. It is very complex and a lot of energy consumed in that. So right. Our software is designed to actually speed up that inventorying process, and it also is able to simplify it so that internal corporate facilities personnel are actually able to inventory a building and perform the assessments without the need to have actual engineers, which is a lot more expensive to do. And the
so yours is more of an automated, like once you've got to kind of get it set up, it's kind of plug and play, and it's
exactly.
Keeping track of stuff on its own.
Exactly.
It sounds to me that and this is this is coming from someone that got their MBA some time back, but it sounds to me that as if what you're doing is combining site selection and enterprise resource planning and applying that to real estate construction.
Right. That's absolutely correct.
And this is a new idea in this industry, right?
You know, well, I won't say it's a new idea. It's being applied in a new way.
Right.
Right? Because most of the times these companies do these assessments, they turn the data over to their owner in a three-ring binder, and it's out of date the minute they walk away from it.
Oh, so historically it's been done with paper.
Paper. Exactly.
Now, Micah, can you imagine that? Closets full of binders, and they go, hey, how's the water system? And then you're like, water, with W, you're going down, right?
I'm closing my eyes, and it's not a pretty picture.
So are construction companies and builders, are they open to this, or are they just saying, hey, we used to do it this way, and that's good enough for us?
Well, the fortunate thing for us is it's driven mostly by the owners or the managers of the real estate,
uh-huh.
right? Because they are the ones that stand to benefit the most.
Right.
Where the value comes in for the construction companies that we talk and market to is there's a movement now to have the ability to move data from that's collected during construction all the way through the cycle and flow of information into the systems that companies use to manage their real estate on an ongoing basis.
Right.
And so the federal government had actually developed a standard for identifying and tracking that data called the COBE, which stands for the Construction Operations Building Information Exchange.
Uh-huh.
And it's basically a simple way to identify all the data and components in the building and allow you to integrate with that CAD facilities management applications, et cetera.
So that's a requirement.
Right. Exactly. With the federal government right now, GSA has it as a requirement. And so for the builders out there, it allows them to capture that information during construction and as a value add, say, guess what, Mr. Owner, we have the data in a format that can go directly into the systems you're using.
So now the requirement is just to capture all the data, and they don't care if it's in the three-ring binder or not, and you're just taking it up a notch
right.
by making
it digital.
We're
making it electronic. We're making it real-time. We're making it easy to update and dynamic so it can be used over the entire life cycle of the building.
And obviously this new requirement is going to help speed adoption of services along the line. Okay, yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. That's absolutely right.
So now, are your targets mostly brand new construction? Does it work on existing construction? Is it government facilities? What's your sweet spot?
So our sweet spot is really in existing buildings.
Existing.
Right? Existing buildings.
Because they got the most problems.
Say that.
Right.
Right. They've got the most problems. Exactly. And they also consume the most energy.
Energy. Mm.
People estimate that, you know, in a building that's, say, a 25-year-old building, you probably have about close to 70% of the energy wasted in that building.
How much?
70%.
70, not 17.
Right, 70 wasted. And a lot of that has to do with improperly functioning mechanical systems, like your heating systems, your cooling systems in that building, as well as obviously outdated light fixtures and things of that nature.
So now if they plugged in your system, how would that improve that number?
So what our system will allow them to do is to prioritize the things they should fix first and what will have the biggest impact on that bottom line dollar they spend on their energy consumption. Mm-hmm. It allows them to fix things at the optimal time and thus eventually drive down that energy cost.
Can you give a building owner an idea of what payback's going to be with an initial assessment?
Yes. With an initial assessment, once we've pulled in all the data, we can give them an idea of what their payback would typically be.
And is that part of your sales pitch, or do you require some sort of commitment from the building before you're willing to tell them?
No. That's a part of the sales pitch is that we can do that. And actually, with our customers, we'll go in and we'll do a proof of concept with them. We ask them to, you know, let's identify one building.
Right.
So we cater to REITs. Hmm. As one of our segments, right? So we'll go in, let's get a smaller building, a small office building you may own, and let's inventory the building, let's look at what you have, and let's identify where the opportunities are. And we kind of do that, use that as a proof of concept at no cost to them.
Oh, wow.
See the value,
try it for
and
nothing?
Then we can scale it.
Do you run into many REITs here in Atlanta? I'm an investment advisor, and I know the investment, so I'm not familiar with that many REITs in Atlanta.
You know, there aren't a ton of REITs here in Atlanta, but what you do have some large ones. You've got Cousins Properties.
Okay, sure.
You've got Wells Real Estate Fund. Mm-hmm. And then you've got, you know, some satellite offices of some other companies. While not necessarily a REIT, they're certainly a huge real estate company and have a lot of interest. C.B. Richard Ellis.
Okay.
Jones Lang LaSalle, companies of that name.
So you're not always on a plane then?
No. Not always on a plane.
Excellent.
Not always on a plane.
So now your role as the CEO, are you spending most of your time drumming up sales? Or are you doing the actual work? Or
I'm spending
how many people are in your company?
Sales is actual work, just for our listeners out there.
Exactly. So we have 10 people in the company.
Uh-huh.
I spend the bulk of my time meeting with customers, meeting with potential customers, setting up demos, walking customers through. I even go in and help inventory the buildings, whatever it takes to help the customers out. We have one other gentleman who's our CTO who oversees all the development.
Right.
And he spends all of his time constantly developing the application and improving on it. And that's one of the things we're really excited about is we've already started working on the next generation of the application, which adds in building automation. So we'll be tying into real-time readings from the equipment that we're inventorying in the building so we can give you real-time operating feedback through our application.
Now, will it take it to another level to actually make adjustments, or is it just kind of reacting to the data?
It absolutely does. So in the basic form, we'll be able to make adjustments. So think in terms of one of the most common mechanical systems in the building or around the HVAC systems are they're called VAVs. It stands for variable airflow volume boxes. Mm-hmm. They basically regulate the airflow into a given space, a given zone, mm-hmm. And controls the temperature. Very simple box, but perform a very important role in the buildings.
Right.
The building across the street from us here has 1,700 of those things installed.
1,700 boxes.
1,700 boxes. Those boxes require a controller on them today that's run by a proprietary controller that runs $2,000 for each one of those 1,700 boxes. The box basically has an actuator arm that opens and closes to control the airflow.
Right.
The controllers that are there today monitor air pressure and things of that nature, but they don't actually move the actuator. What we're doing from our software is tying into those boxes with controls on the motor that can actually control and adjust the actuator based upon changes in desired room conditions, whether it's temperature or whatever it may be.
Mm-hmm.
We can do the same thing for lighting controls as well.
So and those are the big energy sucks, those two things?
Those are huge energy sucks, yeah. Lighting and your HVAC. Mm-hmm. Huge.
One of the more painful things that I've done in life in terms of a volunteer opportunity is I was president of my HOA. And the building will remain unnamed, but we've got about, there are two towers here in Atlanta. It's the largest building inside the perimeter. It sounds like to me that your technology could be very useful in the multi-tenant space as well. Are you focusing there at all?
Yes. And we are focusing there because one of the things that if you think about it from a REIT's perspective and we're looking at tenants, one of the value propositions is how can they differentiate themselves from the competition and make their buildings more attractive to people that are coming in, right? Whether it's multifamily residential and you're trying to get more people into your condos, we know the multifamily has a huge supply on the market here in Atlanta right now. How do you attract in the highly competitive Class A office space? How are you attracting those tenants? So we allow you to engage the tenants in the process and make the engagement process seamless. So we've got a portal piece that ties into our software that tenants are able to use for submitting their requests. There's mobile apps for all of the stuff that ties into it. And you can actually have them book their own conference room reservations within their space, things of that nature, and have it control the lighting. Right, you don't need the lights on. You don't need the air running when no one's using.
Right,
space.
So like if somebody says I want to book at 10 p.m. on Sunday,
exactly,
then they just do that on their phone, and then they just show up there, and the light, you know, they get lights.
It pops on a few minutes ahead, gets the room to the optimal temperature, and when they come in, everything's ready to go. Power is alive, the projector's ready to run, all that stuff's good to go.
And you're working through the REITs for that. You're not working directly with the properties at this point.
Right.
Okay.
Right, exactly. We're working with the REITs for that today.
Again, going back to my volunteer experience, it's probably best not to work directly with the properties.
You want to be up the food chain as high as you can.
Absolutely.
Out of all the construction companies I work with, I don't know of very many that actually made money at the end of the day doing multifamily residential.
Right.
You got a lot of owners to work with. In those
Those
punch lists are pretty rough.
So where do you see this moving to? You say you're updating the software to make it more robust. It seems like there's a lot of opportunity out there because the way that it's being done now seems like when you describe the way you're doing it compared to the way it's being done, the way it's being done seems like kind of archaic.
So where we see it developing is more and more automation, right? At the end of the day, every component in the building should be able to talk to the people responsible for maintaining those buildings. So we're working with a company by the name of Digi International today, and they manufacture various types of sensors and wireless transmitters. And we're looking at more innovative ways to take that equipment and tie it into the components of the building. So we can get to the point where we can monitor things such as water pressure within the pipes. So we can have preemptive measures that can be taken to prevent leaks before they even happen, right? Before there's a leak that springs somewhere along the way, long before the actual leak happens,
you can sense
there's a
weakness,
drop in pressure,
right?
So that's where I see this going, is that we will continue to develop the automation, the monitoring piece, and connecting all the components of a building to the people that are responsible for maintaining it.
Well, it seems like your background of being this involved and then you coupling that with this new technology makes you guys pretty well suited to for the challenge.
We'd like to think so. We've got a great group of folks at the company. We have some very smart individuals, and they're constantly thinking and bringing new ideas, and we have a great group of clients that are constantly challenging us.
Are you seeking new investors to expand?
We are not seeking new investors as of today. The company's been funded with a group of angel investors that have done an incredible job as well of helping us down the path as we've just kind of built the business. So for right now, we are not seeking funding. We do anticipate once we get to the stage where we are adding the additional building automation in, we will be looking for some additional funding at that point, and that's probably about 8 to 10 months out to scale.
Okay. All right.
Now, if somebody wanted to learn more, is there a website for Corvado?
There is. They can check us out at www.corvado.com.
Cool. Well, thank you so much, Ortez, for being part of the show, and we look forward to learning more about what you guys are up to as you guys grow.
Lee, Micah, thank you.
All right. Next up, we got another person that I met at Venture Atlanta, Michael Kadger, and he is with Monocle Health Systems or Data. I was getting confused.
Data.
Well, welcome, Mike. How did Venture Atlanta work for you?
I thought it was really good for multiple reasons. One is I met a bunch of other companies that I think fit well with our company.
Oh, nice. Make a little mashup?
Yeah. I think we identified some folks who, while we have some overlapping services, they do some things that we don't, and we do some things that they don't. But I think between us, we can probably develop some good synergies and better products.
And you were pitching yesterday, right?
Yes, I was one of the presenters.
Six minutes of fun and games over there?
6 minutes, and thank goodness they didn't turn the clock on until 3 minutes in.
Oh, so you got 9 minutes?
I did, and I used every bit of it.
Now, why don't you share a little bit about what Monocle is up to? Because it's very unique and it's very disruptive.
Yeah, what Monocle Health Data does is we rank doctors and hospitals on price and quality for the treatment of chronic illnesses as well as episodic care. The chronic illnesses being such things as we can tell you which doctors are most efficient and most proficient, best quality for treating a 45-year-old male with type 2 diabetes, with asthma and high blood pressure.
Right. And when you say these ratings, these aren't subjective ratings, right?
No, they're all based on facts. We go out and license data from about a dozen different sources. And some of it's public, some of it's private, some of it's quasi-public, some of it you have to buy, some of it's free. The point is that healthcare data is in a lot of different locations. We go out and acquire it, download it, take their quality indicators, attach it to a disease, attach it to a physician who's treated that disease or hospital, and then we rank them based on how efficient they are. That is, did they do this using more supplies, tests, resources than average or below average or at average? And then we take the quality data and we use various quality indicator points, data points there, and we rank those as well. But we're not Angie's List. We're not a survey. We don't.
Right, it's not Yelp.
You know? Right. That was going to be my question. Do I go to monocledata.com and find out, hey, here's who I look at?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
And
it's objective information. It's not like you like them and gave them, you know, 4 stars.
Good point. Yeah. the doctor was nice to me before he put me under, kind of thing.
Right.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
His hands are always warm.
Right. Right.
Now, we use hard data from multiple sources and then put it into an algorithm that weights each of those quality indicators. And we have 72 quality indicators that we use, and it generates 68 reports in a data cube. And that's all the techie data stuff. But what it really does is for the patients, it allows them to identify who treats their illness best. And that's important for a couple reasons. One is high deductible health plans are the trend. Whether, you know, the current federal health plan stays in place or not, doesn't really matter. People are going to have to pay more out of pocket. And people are increasingly aware that there are huge price and quality disparities. I'll give you an example. There was a survey done, it was published, that showed that the range for a simple appendectomy with no complications was from $1,500 to
$183,000. $183,000?
Yes.
You're kidding me.
And the national average is $33,000. Now, a lot of people say, but it doesn't matter, I hit my deductible. Okay?
Right.
Well, it's going to increasingly matter. In addition, what I found when I developed centers of excellence for cardiac, obstetrics, orthopedic surgery, mental health, for big employers like Delta Airlines, Halliburton, AT&T, what I found was that there is an inextricable link between quality and price. We discovered the obvious. Those providers that do a lot of one thing do it much better and much cheaper than others. Healthcare is one of the few industries where you actually get paid twice when you make a mistake. So
that's right.
We identify those who are least likely to make mistakes, who focus on something that they do a lot and get really good results. And so the need for our services is as much, if not more, about quality than price. We honestly believe if you get the best quality, you're going to get the best price.
One of the folks that I've spoken with in recent weeks, not on the show, but in my day job, runs an independent imaging center, MRIs, things along those lines. And one of the points that he made to me was as hospitals are essentially buying patients via buying the physicians groups, that there are fewer and fewer referrals to these independent imaging centers that cost half or less what a hospital costs. So do you see what you're doing as driving patients to places like that, to other providers that, that can offer those services?
Absolutely. One of the things that is unique about what we do, and we have a number of differentiators, and one is that we do all the services. I just mentioned some organizations just do one or two. But we also report the prices of the in-network providers as well as out-of-network. And I'll give an example. Major insurance company says, I have two or three must-have hospitals in my network because they're the big ones, they're prestigious, they do a lot of things. What happens is that hospital might say, or that health system says to the insurer, yeah, we'll contract with you, but you have to exclude that imaging center across the street. Now, I don't think that's fair. I'm a free market capitalist. I believe in competition. I embrace it. I don't always win. But if you win more than you lose, you do well. But we show is if that out-of-network provider offers a service, and if it's a much less cost than the hospital, we're going to call it like we see it. We're independent. We want to make sure the consumer gets the best price at the best quality. And imaging, it's a service that can be done at a pretty highly variable price. We really will essentially reveal that to the consumer. And a perfect example, a friend of mine moved here from Spain, had a lump on his knee, went to the doctor. He was worried about it. Doctor, he thought it was scar tissue. Doctor looked at it and said, good news, bad news. Bad news, it's a tumor. Highly unlikely it's cancer, but we need to get an MRI. And Will says, where do we get an MRI? And he says, well, right next door. But it's kind of expensive. It's about $2,000. And he says, well, you got insurance, right? And Will says, I've been here from Spain 3 weeks. I don't have insurance. He said, bring a check for $250. Now, there's a reason for that.
Right.
Why would the imaging center charge for that? Well, because the insurer pays them that. But it's also a facility that has maybe some slack time. They have some, need to bring patients in. Their variable costs are something less than $250. So, yeah, so bring them in. And that's what we would reveal to consumers. So they may get a better deal out of network, despite what insurers and some networks say. They don't always have the best rates.
Well, as someone who's got an HDHP plan and a new child, having gone through that whole process this year, I got that mention in there, Lee.
Yeah, good job.
Thank you. I am very attuned to cost. Where would I go to find information? Where would I go to find your data, find your information?
Well, we sell to employers.
Okay.
Large self-insured employers in particular at this stage in our development, because statistical validity is very important. We only publish the data in that market for those procedures or illnesses for which we have valid data. So we're pursuing big employers. If you are employed by a large employer, I would encourage them to engage Monocle. We charge no setup fee, no startup fee. In fact, they give us the data. We give 2 months free. Try it out. If you like it, great. Then it's $4 per employee per month thereafter. If they don't like it, then we shake hands and they can walk away.
Tell that story you told me the other day at Venture Atlanta about, how you hear about hospitals and they brag like we're the number one like children's hospital. You were telling an interesting story about one of these hospitals that were bragging they're the number one children's hospital. But when you start shaking out by procedure, they may not be number one across the board. Why don't you share that story?
It's intuitive that we all have skill sets. We're good at some things and not so good at other things. And it's the true with hospitals and doctors. And one of our analyses from the quality data, and by the way, we have the quality data on every provider, every doctor, every hospital in the United States. We've licensed that data, downloaded it. It's a huge database. It would take somebody forever if they knew where to find it to assimilate it. And we put it out there so it can be done in a matter of 3 or 4 minutes. But what we found was a hospital that had what was called the gold seal, and that is the highest ranking from the Joint Commission on Accreditation of Hospitals. And it's true, great hospital, and overall, great hospital. The problem is, when it came to treating children's asthma, they failed. They only got a score of 60. When the top 10% of hospitals on the treatment of children's asthma, at the top 10%, got an average score of 95. Now, if you want to go to that hospital and your child has a broken leg and needs orthopedic surgery, one of the best. But wouldn't it be good to know, if you have a child with asthma, there probably is a better place to go. And that's what's important. You're not picking hospitals or doctors based upon some purported overall rating. It is very specific to the illness that you have.
Right, at that minute. That's right. What you care about. Do you care that they're the best gold standard hospital if your kid has asthma and they're failing? Right?
It makes a lot of sense. It makes a lot of sense. So, well, you're focused, your end user right now is large employers. You've got a great data set, it sounds like. What are your expansion plans? Where do you go from here?
Well, I try to stay really focused on what we do. We're a data analytics company is what we are. We get a bunch of data and we feed it through two or three different types of software and then come up. We take all this complex, messy data and filter it down to something really usable, which, by the way, that's the toughest part. Making complex things look easy is very, very difficult.
Right.
And I tell our IT people, and it drives them crazy, 6 clicks or less, if you can't get an answer to a question in 6 clicks or less, it doesn't go on the website. You know, and that's the consumerism that we want to focus on. But where we go from here is I'm always looking for byproducts. That is, if you build something but you have a bunch of scrap to the side, that what can you do with that scrap? And one of the things that we have not pursued is electronic health records. It's an emerging field with a lot of different standards, takes a lot of time, and I don't fully understand it. But what I do understand is this. What is the next best substitute for an electronic health record that you pull from a lab and a doctor and an imaging center and a pharmacy and a hospital? Well, the next best proxy is already sitting in the claims data. If you could say to a person, we can create a record for you and store it securely so that when you go to the doctor's office, you know how they always hand you the clipboard, although you've been seeing this right. doctor for 10 years, fill it out again.
Right. Right.
Like say nothing has changed. Doesn't right. matter. Right. Fill it out again.
Right. Like it's the first time, right?
Yeah. Well, you just give them a card, and by golly, they swipe it, download the claims data, pulls it up, lists all the tests that you've had. If you want supplemental information as the results of the test, that's good. But through an inference engine, basically what are statistical data points, if somebody's taking or buying a lot of blood glucose tests or, you know, supplies, you think they're diabetic?
You can infer.
I'll bet. So what we do is an inference engine to take all that scrap data, put it into a substitute health record that's already pre-populated that then the person can make their own notes on. And I give an example. Obama has earmarked $47 billion to create a personal health record, and it'll be ready in 12 years. Well, you take $47 billion, divided by 12 years, divided by 12 months, divided by the average population of the United States during that time. The number's $1.35 a month a person. Well, average family size, let's say it's 3. So, you know, you're paying somewhere a little bit less than $4.50. But it's data storage and bandwidth, and it's mostly static, you know, except when the when it's paid. I mean, when you get a new claim set. I won't tell you what the cost is of doing that, but I'll just say it's a lot less than $1.35. I think we can provide it, you know, like right now, for a buck and make a lot of money.
Because that data is already available.
It's already there.
And what you're doing, though, is you're essentially shortcutting the process. You're not waiting on them to get their act together on the front end to create these records. You're taking the data that's already there and reassembling it, essentially.
That's exactly right.
And the accuracy rate of that data from the inference engine is?
It's about 90%.
Okay.
You know,
which is probably about as accurate as it would be if it were assembled on the front end.
Exactly. Yeah. And a lot
and you
less
don't have to wait 12 years.
Right. Or $1.35 a month.
Yeah.
Right.
You know, people say, oh, it's only $1.35. Yeah, well, that's $47 billion. but, you know, I look at that and think, you know, if we could substitute a product, sell it now, I don't need 50% market share. I mean, I'll do with 5, you know.
Cortez is familiar with the GSA. He may be able to provide you some phone numbers into the government.
That's right. Well, it's interesting both of you kind of play around with data pretty good. Mike, is there a website for you guys? I know you're looking for funds, so if people want to invest, you're open to that conversation. And it seems like you're open also to some partnerships if somebody's got a creative way to complement your service.
Absolutely. It's www.monoclehealth.com. And Monocle is MONOCLE health.com. And our business model, we actually contract with best in class to perform the various functions. And then what I do is integrate those services into a product that's very detailed and convert it into something that's very simple. And that's the value that we add. We do it on a real-time basis. We know where to find the data. We aggregate it. Very high value, virtually all variable costs. I like to say we create nothing but value, and which is sort of an understatement, but we want to make this very affordable for consumers. I got my first job out of college as a hospital accountant, and been in healthcare for 32 years, healthcare finance, and I've always marveled at why it is so needlessly complex. And we want to commoditize healthcare just like groceries. You know, there should be no mystery in it. A can of Campbell's soup at Kroger's cost X and at Publix it cost Y. And you can decide where you want to go for your care and you get to pick your quality. And, you know, we just make it very, very simple. And we're looking for funds, but more importantly, we're looking for strategic partners. Mm-hmm. I have funded this largely myself, as well as our law firm and our accounting firm, which is quite an achievement.
Well, if you get to the point that you consider large employers, employers with 4 employees, give me a call, please. I can use that data.
Well, I'll tell you what we're going to do. In about a year, we will have an individual product out there. We will have sufficient statistically valid data in the select markets to be able to offer that. And that's our goal. I mean, it really is. It's our potential market at the price that we charge, which is less than our competitors, but it's about a $4.8 billion annual market. Large self-insured employers represent about 2/3 of that, but a lot of it is individuals. And as our economy has morphed from the big companies to smaller companies, it's the smaller companies that need more help with this.
Right, right.
And so we're kind of on a mission. But and by the way, my father was a rocket scientist. He worked for Bell Labs on the Nike Zeus anti-ballistic missile system during the Cuban Missile Crisis. And he developed the console that would guide this missile to knock ICBMs out of the sky. And my mother was a public health nurse. About as two different people as you can imagine. For my dad, everything had a very exact and precise single answer. My mother was a little more, you know, you got to take the big picture into account. So I kind of feel like it's, as my mom would say, when one person gets sick, it makes everybody sick. Not in a way of contagiousness of the disease, but economic contagiousness. If they don't go to work, somebody else has got to do their job. If someone else has to do their job, it puts a hardship on someone else. That person that's sick doesn't make money. They're not productive. And it's very important that we make our society as productive as possible. And the best way to do that is to help them be good consumers. And they can't rely, as we know, we cannot rely on the government to tell us how to do that. Because the biggest savings that will be generated in the future will be from consumers having to be involved in the purchase process and making choices.
Good stuff. Well, Micah, that wraps up another episode. Would you learn something?
I learned a good bit. I'm going to have to go to lunch and think over all of this.
All right. Well, thanks again to our sponsor, Minerva Planning Group, the good folks who provide their clients with financial peace of mind. Check them out online at MinervaPlanningGroup.com. This is Lee Cantor for Micah Porter. We will see you all next time on Disruptive Business.